Okay, hello everyone. I'm Robert Böhme from the Part-Time Scientist, and we are doing four short presentations here. First of all, I want to give you a short introduction on what the Google Lunar X Prize is and what we as a team want to achieve in this regard. This is more or less a non-technical presentation, the first part. The second part will be totally based around our lunar rover prototype, the current development model for 2009, which will be revealed live on stage by Michael and Jürgen. The third part will be featuring our board computing unit. Yeah, simply call it this way. And the fourth part, the last part, is something which was quite a secret right now, which will be revealed today. Some real, very cool new way to do deep space communications in future. So this is the last part of it. Okay, so first I have to say we are no professionals by any means in regards of presentation, so please bear with us a little bit and let's see how this works out, okay? Okay, so start. So first of all, what is the Google Lunar X Prize? Before I start with the Google Lunar X Prize, let us say what is the X Prize anyway, because X Prize, just a word. In the history, if you look back at it, an X Prize itself is just a prize set out to achieve something that is really far away, that hasn't been done by anyone so far, and where there is, for mostly economic, no reason to do it right now. So one example in history of this is the Spirit of St. Louis. So if you know Charles Lindbergh, you can see him here, flew an airplane from America to France about 1920, and successfully did it, and this was in regards of a competition set out to win a $10,000 prize money. $10,000 isn't quite much in nowadays dimension, but back then it was quite a lot of money, and this prize money was set out by one single individual just to see if something like this could be possible. This prize money really put out a development where people tried to see how can I build an airplane to cross the distance from America to Europe. So, okay, take this to our times. One very recent example of our times is the Ansari X Prize. The Ansari X Prize was set up by the X Prize Foundation, which is a non-profit organization based in the US, back in 2004. The goal was to build a space suborbital spaceship, which is capable of doing a reusable re-entry in the Earth's atmosphere. So, meaning you have to get about higher than 100 kilometers above Earth's ground. And you have to do it two times in less than 14 days without exchanging more than 10% of the parts you used in the first try. May sound a bit complicated, but the idea behind this is that you don't use throwaway spaceships like most of the rocket engines we nowadays use. And this competition was won pretty fast, as one can say, with Spaceship OneCraft. This is the first non-government manned spacecraft in 2004. So this was the first X Prize that really kicked off along history of X Prizes that followed. Right now there are about three active X Prizes, one about human genome, automotive industry, so building more efficient cars, and the X Prize we participate in, the Google Lunar X Prize. To give you an idea of what the Google Lunar X Prize in the state right now, the Google Lunar X Prize is going on for 2 years right now, and after 2 years we have 21 teams from over 12 nations participating. So, okay, you may say, yeah, okay, let's put up together a team to create a mission to the moon. So why not? But the point is, you can't simply say you want to set up a team to participate in the Google Lunar X Prize. You have to present a complete concept, and you have to prove that, put it in more fine words, and not totally nuts. So you have to prove that you're professional enough to at least have a chance to achieve it. So all the countries you can see highlighted in white are countries where teams have already formed to participate in the Google Lunar X Prize. One great thing about the Google Lunar X Prize is there's Normally, all prices, NASA does a lot of prices, like the Northrop Grumman Lander Challenge, where you have to build a lunar lander module, which can land on the Earth's surface and starts again, and so on. These prizes are a lot only based for only for persons who live in the USA. This has something to do with laws and regulations over in the US, where you can use US tax money only for persons that are living in the US itself. So if the, NASA would set out the Google Lunar X Prize, so it would be the NASA Lunar X Prize, no German or any other team then coming from America could participate in it. So the Google Lunar X Prize is really something extraordinary because teams from all parts of the world can take part in it. Okay. So what is so special about the Google Lunar X Prize? So if you take a look at this picture, it's pretty much well known to everyone. It's a so-called Earthrise picture. It's a picture taken from the moon where you can see the Earth rising up. So one thing that this picture doesn't show to you is one important thing. It's the distance between Earth and Moon. It's more than 400,000 kilometers. And it's, if you want to get to the Moon, it's not just a straight line. We have to do a lot of trajectory calculations to find your way with an aircraft, a spacecraft from Earth to the Moon. I will show you more details about this later. This is just an introduction part. So it's a little bit out of range here. So, okay. Just show you something about the topics that the Google Lunar X Prize has and the prize money about it. Huh. Poor Mario. Okay, so we have a grand prize where you have to, with $20 million, for $20 million you have to build a spacecraft, not spacecraft, you have to build a rover, send it to the moon, and the rover has to travel 500 meters on the lunar surface and transmit a so-called Mooncast data package back to Earth. Mooncast itself may sound pretty much Web 2.0, but it really is something pretty cool idea behind this, because the Mooncast says you have to transmit real-time HD 720p video signal back to Earth. So, think about it a little bit. We have 400,000 kilometers on one side on distance, and we have real-time HD video streaming signals, and we have something that you don't know about it, but we will come to that later. We have the fact that the technology we can use in space due to radiation is not the same that you can use right now when you go to, let's say, MediaMarkt and buy a new laptop. So it's not that powerful. So we don't have simply have the capability right now to do HD real-time video encoding. But we'll show you to do, we'll show you some way to do this. So what about the second and third prize? The second prize is the Heritage Prize. The Heritage Prize is about shooting a picture of a so-called site of interest. To say it more easily, you have to shoot a picture of the Apollo landing site. So you have to prove that you were there, shoot a photo, and if you do so, you get $4 million. So I think every one of you know why they set out a $4 million prize to get a picture from the Apollo landing site. Okay, so we have got another prize, but I don't think this prize will be there much longer because it is the water detection bonus prize. And after the latest LCROSS results, I think this prize will, let's say, at least get a little bit smaller prize because right now we get $4 million to prove the existence of water on the moon, but the last LCROSS mission of NASA already did it, so I'm not sure how this evolves. And there's one thing to note about it in scientific regards. If you want to prove water ice on the moon, you have to go for one from one of the South Pole, for example. Nearly all moon missions, lunar missions right now, were going for equatorial reasons. This has something to do with the landing trajectory and the surface. The surface on the moon is pretty much cluttered, so you have gaps of the size of 15 meters. So if you got a rover with a length of, let's say, 1 meter, and you have a gap like 15 meters, so you have simply no way to go around it. And in equatorial regions, you don't have this problem. You have very fine regolith sand. It's almost all one flat place. And at the pole region, you have every meter craters and a harsh environment, so it's pretty much hard to travel on the South Pole. So and then if you have the range bonus prize. The range bonus prize is simply an addition. You have to travel 5 kilometers instead of 500 meters. I think the range bonus price is something simply a pretty good idea, which shows the good concept of the XPRIZE, because there are many teams, as I said before, 21 teams, and there are simply teams that are building rovers which can travel 500 meters and instantly fall apart. It's something that we built with rocket engines, so they have a fuel deposit, and if this fuel deposit gets burned out, the rover is stood still. So it's not a very intelligent design, as I think. It's only made up to win this competition, but it doesn't help the world in any technological reason. What we try to achieve is always to get an advantage for everyone out of this. But we will come to that later. Okay, so then there's the survival prize. It's something I really like about this. The survival prize, you have to survive 14.5 days on the lunar surface over a lunar night. The lunar night and the lunar day have quite a lot of difference, because we have on the lunar day you have plus 160 degrees, and at the lunar night you have minus 160 degrees. So, and the shape over time vector, I don't have a graphic in this, but I could show you afterwards. There's a graphic I have created, so you could see that they have only about, let's say, 2 hours where these two extreme differences collide together. Normally, every hardware you have right now, for example, this laptop, would immediately break apart because of the extreme temperature differences. But just doosh, and back. Yeah. Sorry. Okay. And the last but not least is the diversity bonus prize. Diversity bonus prize is something they set up to encourage teams to take people to don't just make German-based teams. I heard of teams who are just for locals, like people from California or something like this. This is something I really don't like, because right now we're living in a world where we have the internet and everyone's connected with everyone. Why should everyone not be allowed to work together in a team like this? That's why the diversity prize encourages teams to invite people like them. For example, our team has team members all across the globe. I will show you a slide about this later on. So, not just local-based teams. Okay, let's sum up the complicated things about the XPRIZE. It's just an easy summarization. So first you have to get to the moon. Getting to the moon, I will show you how we do this at the end of this presentation slide. Then secondly, second, that's relative complicated part. You have to do a soft landing on the lunar surface. Soft landing on the lunar surface is not like you see on many videos from Mars landings or science fiction movies. The lunar surface has no atmosphere. I saw teams proposing to use airbags to land on the moon.
It's trying to call you.
Oh.
You might want to hang up or just tell him you're busy or something.
No problem. I think I will call him back later. He knows the time when he's due.
Okay. Cool. Just thought you should know.
Oh, our special guest has been revealed. Sorry. Okay. Soft landing, hard part. Next one, communication. Communication, as I said before, we have a special presentation at this at the end. So I just leave out the details, but it's very, it's okay. I'm not accepting right now because it's take too long to explain to him that we can do this in 30 minutes when it's due. okay, and the survival of the lunar night. The survival of the lunar night, as I said before, is not just about temperature. the intention for this picture was something like everything's better with bacon. Okay, one thing I want to say in regards of this, you don't have to adjust the temperature, you have the radiation. But the radiation, Arne will give you some details about this, what the radiation means for your computers or your iPhone, whatever you have, and some nice pictures of this later on. Okay, so just see what slide I got next. This is just a transition over to the next section. I'm really into animations. Okay, so let's talk about budgets. This is a topic I really like, because we've got NASA. So everyone knows NASA back from the 60s. So, does everyone know what budget they had back in the 60s? Let's take a look at this number. It's 90,870,000,000 current euros, euro. I translated it to the current unit euro, because US dollars number would be quite longer. Okay, and if you look at this number, it's simply incredible. You can't say anything about it. But they had to develop a whole lot of new technology back in the 60s, so we're taking this into credit. Just compared to nowadays moon missions. So one of the latest moon missions we had was the Chandrayaan moon missions set out by India. They used a lot of components available on the free market, so just not just bought, but they just bought components like rocket engines and so on. And so they got to the relatively small price of 64 million euros. Then there was the... this was only orbiting missions, not just landing on the surface, just getting to the moon, orbiting, taking pictures, and crashing down sometime. Okay, and then we had the LCROSS mission, which was quite successfully in the last 2 months, and it was about 53 million euro. And let's compare this to the Google Lunar X Prize. So you see, you get a prize money of 20 million euro, and even the cheapest moon mission we had so far, and moon missions who buy all off-the-shelf technology, required a lot of more money to do this. So, just for one, before I start talking about this, this is what we have in mind for our moon mission. It's not just a number I'm showing up, it's just our planning schedule. We are not going to exceed any more than this amount of money. This has something to do with the things I will show you in the next slides. So, okay. It's quite an easy summation. Okay, first of all, we are not going to build any kind of rocket or rocket engine. So we are not totally nuts and going into our skets and pulling together rocket fuel and blowing us up. So it's something you can't do something like this. They have to say it. It took NASA 10 years to build a rocket that's not going to explode just to lift up. They have to say it. They had exploding rockets every week at their testing ground. So it's not easy. And you can't say, okay, I'm going to build a rocket. No way. So you have to buy one. So actually, there is something new development in this regard. So most of you, I don't know if you know about it. There is a space provider. It's called SpaceX. they're providing you the capability to get payloads to low Earth orbit using self-built rocket engines, and they're quite good at it. They have the Falcon series, but we save some pictures on it later, so just spare this one. Okay, the second part, as I said before, our approach is to using much as possible existing technology. So you'll see in the upcoming slides, we are not reinventing everything. Okay, just skip to the next one. So, and one important thing, it's a low budget. Why I'm saying this? Low budget always try to be bad things, low budgets, because they are limiting you, you can't do this, because you don't have money for this. Think about the following. If you have a lot of money lying around and you say, okay, this is your budget, it's about 1 billion, let's say US dollars. What can you do with it? Why not? Let's waste some millions on some studies and look at this and another millions goes by. There are a lot of studies happening just to see, could it be possible to do this or this? And this study just costs some millions. I don't want to make any special... I can talk about this topic afterwards because I have some examples for this, but I don't want to blame anyone right now. But there are simply not useful studies going on. And they're taking a lot of money, and if you take this money, you could simply finance a moon mission by itself immediately. So... Okay, so having a low budget means you don't waste money. That's what I want to say with it. So innovation. Innovation is something everyone says right now, nowadays. It just means that we try to use most of high technology as possible. As again, you will see this later on. So we are not using technologies back from 1995. So, okay. And, Jack again. Okay, no time. This is applying right now too. No time just means the first deadline for the Google Lunar X Prize is the end of 2012. It's not the end of the world, it's just the end of 2012. So, at the end of 2012, the XPRIZE prize money fee will be reduced by, I think, about 10 million. So, you really have all teams are encouraged to reach the moon and all goals associated with it before 2012. This is really a short time frame. If you think about it, NASA and other agencies took about 10 or 8 years to plan such a mission like this. I know that DLR had planned a mission about 5 or 6 years and it didn't even happen. So just planning, you can spend a lot of time with it. And last but not least, I'm just writing, we are not reinventing the cow. Why I'm saying not reinventing the cow? Normally you would say we are not reinventing the wheel, but we are reinventing the wheel. You will see this in Michael's presentation. Okay. Okay, so just one thing about us. Currently, our team consists of 33 people with all from all nations, from all professions. Just to give you a quick overview, we have engineers, we have aerospace professionals, students, broadcast engineers, retired military staff, we have economists. Yeah, you need them too. We have IT professionals, obviously, like me. And we have technical programmers. You need a lot of them. And what is really great, and this is where Jack Crenshaw, our special guest, comes in, we have some members from the retired Apollo staff, which are really great guys to work with, I have to say this. And they really have fun working on this again, because they did it 40 years ago. Okay, and last but not least, we have our partners, sponsors, and so on. Okay, and maybe you. So we're always interested in getting new members. So if you maybe have something special skills, because we have always looking for special skill sets, just talk to us after the presentation. We're having, okay, I should say that. We're preparing a booth outside on the right-hand side of this room, on the outer side, to where you can see all the technology. I brought some special boards and so on with us, so you can see it, touch it, and so on. Yeah. And there are some things for free, giveaways from our partners and from us. Okay. This is something I want to skip through very fast. So I have created a timeline where you can see all the first time events happening in regards of space exploration. You will quickly see what I mean. The first satellite ever. So we have Lunar Impactor and so on. I will just skip too soon because the intention of this timeline is not just to show any single event by itself. It's because to show you that the events are decreasing, not increasing. We have a relatively high increase through the 80s, and starting with the 90s, you will see it's rapidly going downwards. So space exploration, I'm not going to say it's falling asleep, but it really isn't that interesting anymore like what's in the 60s or 70s. So there was lots of things, very interesting things happening in the 70s and 80s, like the first space station and so on. Oops, okay. Yeah, this was the launch of the Columbia, okay. Ah, it's a bit quick right now. But you can see the slides afterwards, so you can look at the pictures, anyone individual. Just because I haven't much time planned in for this, we could talk half an hour about just about all these events. Okay. So, and now we are in the 90s. So you see we get the Hubble telescope, and then we are in 2000. So no first event besides Hubble in between. Okay, you would say sometimes all first events are gone and you have to do normal stuff, but not having any special thing like being the first one, first rover on Venus or something like Russia had, means that you are simply stuck. You don't have doing any research, or you're simply not doing any progress. Maybe you are doing a lot of research, but you're not trying something. You're sitting at home and planning about it. So this guy is really great. It's Dennis Tito. It's the first private space tourist. The part that he took was something that really kicked off some very interesting, because people, after him, people tend to be more interested in regards of space, because they say, hey, okay, private person getting into space, maybe I could do it too. If you see here, China started its space program, and they're pretty much advanced right now. And, as again, 2004, we have Spaceship One, the first private spaceship. So as you see, after 2000, private people are getting their share of space exploration. So, and there should be only one additional mission. Ah, it's Cassini, okay. And that should be it. Yes, it was. Okay, now come to the last part. It's a little bit more technical. And then we come to the rover part. So, again, with some very interesting animations. I have to say regarding this animation system, it's a self-developed 3D OpenGL-based rendering software. Yeah, there could be many reasons why we've wrote it, but I have to simply have to say that normal slideshow presentation software are simply too lame. You have to. If you have a lot of pictures on your slides, you have big files and so on, and you can't do it. With this software, you can simply use vector graphics or TIFF files and just animate them any way you want with effects. So it's quite interesting. OK, back to our working. Now we're talking a bit more technical details. As I'm a person, I favor technical details. So OK, so we have a picture of the Falcon 1E rocket. The Falcon 1E is, as I said before, a rocket developed by the SpaceX. So what our team tries to use as our carrier device, not to the moon, I have to say this, not to the moon, because they have direct and indirect transactions to get to the moon. We want to get to the low Earth orbit first, and from the low Earth orbit with a second engine to the moon. This is, may sound more complicated than having a rocket which gets you to the moon in a direct way, but it's a lot of better, but it's a little bit more complicated to explain. Maybe I'm not sure about it if Jack tells a little bit about this, because this involves a lot of delta V factors and mathematics in this regard. Okay, one thing we really want to achieve, and we are currently having working together with SpaceX in this regard. If you read Wikipedia or something like this, you will see always see a number like, if you want to send something to low Earth orbit, you have to pay $10,000 per kilogram. It's quite a normal number. It's always, everyone says it. We've developed some modifications where we want to get below this number. This really helps you, because if you think $10,000 per kilogram, I want to do some things first. As our rover will be presented, we'll only have about 5 kilograms. And it would be $50,000 just to get it to the low Earth orbit, not considering all the fuel you need to go there. So getting below this really helps to get more people to shoot something in this direction. Okay, and this is just for info, we have about 1,010 kilograms of mass to low Earth orbit currently. This intakes about 80% of fuel. This is something quite special, because normal missions are packed full of electronics and experiments and get a little bit less fuel, and what you have end up is something like LCROSS. You have a mission with a relatively short lifetime. Okay, maybe you fulfill all your requirements in this short lifetime, but you can't do anything later on. So, for example, if you run out of fuel, your craft will simply crash on the surface. So, there's nothing you can do with it any longer, and you can't get any backup fuel or so. So, planning into a lot of fuel reserves really extends your mission lifetime. So, you can do more things, let me say, 5 years after you finished your mission. Okay, the lunar lander is something that is quite a secret right now, but one thing that are currently public is the mass of 300 kilograms. And one very important thing. Our lunar lander tries to do the same as Russia did before. We want to do an automatic sample return mission. So, as I said before, the lander will do a soft landing on the lunar surface. And after this, the rover will depart from the lander. And then the landing part will take a surface probe and will restart again in a relatively short time window. Why the same time window? Because if it's standing still too long, it's cooling out, and you can't get back the engine on. So you have a relatively short time frame to get your sample, get it into the lander, and start the engine up again. So, and you read to the low gravity of the moon, it's relatively easy to get back to Earth. And we've already talked to the agencies necessary. They provided us with an option to do our sample recovery. So we get a surface probe back and get a recovery of this probe for free. Okay, so we have to give some share of the probes, but it's some really cool if you consider the price you have to pay for a sample of regolith. Okay. So the rover itself, I just skipped this one because all the details will be presented by Michael and Jürgen. And some point in regards of the MCU, because Arne shares his part with Jack, and I don't know how long this will take, Jack part, so I'm taking some information beforehand. Our board computing unit is based on an FPGA. If you don't know what an FPGA is, just wait a second, and Arne will explain it later. It's a specialized Xilinx Vertex 4 FPGA, which is doing all analog and digital control. It's something means like you have one chip doing all the work, so you don't have 1,000 components around it like you have nowadays on certain mainboards. And this really minimizes the error counter, and you can do a lot of more things that you will see in the last and the following presentation. And this is the important part. Everything of our component is Hi-Real certified. Hi-Real certified, what does Hi-Real mean? Arne will give you an implementation about this. But this means that these components can withstand exposure to space, just in a brief introduction. Because, as I said before, your normal handy or iPhone simply would fall apart. Not just to temperature, but to radiation and vacuum. Okay, one important thing I'm really a fan of is standardized protocols. So what does this mean? If you think about 20 years ago, you've got a rocket here, you've got an engine there, and you got some thrusters there, and they all got different wirings, different protocols, control engines, control units, and so on. And you don't have to, let's say, at least order have 50 employees just writing up all the control mechanisms to coordinate all this different equipment. Nowadays, vendors set for standardized protocols, so new rockets and engines have, for example, Ethernet as bus system. It's something pretty cool. So you can use Ethernet in your main control unit to connect it and control the engines and all the stress and behavior. Okay. And one very interesting thing is we have built a persistent Hi-Real data storage, which is something quite special because there's not much where you can store data in space due to radiation. Okay, but I'm just leave this to Arne. And this ECC algorithm, I would have liked to talk about this in this presentation, but it really is too complicated, and so I leave it out. But you can talk about, we have a special implementation in this regard, so we can maybe see it in 1 year on Wikipedia or so. Okay, so this almost was it. Just one last slide, and we can go to the rover. The last slide is something for me pretty important because.
No?
Okay. And just a summarization of our current partners. We have a lot of public and non-public partners. Just naming from one side to one side. We have Texas Instruments. We have CatSoft, which are producing the software maybe most of you know as Eagle. We have Maxon Motor, SolidWorks. Then we have the Solid Line AG. Then we have Schneider-Kreuznach, MindMeister, and very important, Xilinx, and what I really like is O'Reilly. The folks at O'Reilly are absolutely great, I have to say this. Not just the books, but the folks too, absolutely. Okay, this is one my first part. Der Funkempfang ist manchmal nicht da, da musst du einen Tick rübergehen.
Okay. Hello? My name is Michael, and I will tell you something about the status of our rover development. We will talk about the requirements we need to build a rover. Jürgen will tell about the concepts, the rover we have, especially the mass. We will show you something hardware we built in the last year. I will show you some pictures of the technology we use in our rover, and we will take a short view in the future of our rover development. Requirements. First requirements, as Robert said, will be set by the Google Luna X Prize. 500 meters driving and Mooncast. Mooncast, remember, was sending text files, sending a live stream, and so on. We have requirements we set on ourselves. That means 5,000 meters driving and surviving the lunar night. But all of these requirements have to face the moon. The moon sets his own requirements, and the first and most important is temperature. We have minus 160 degrees at night and plus 160 degrees at day. And to find material that handle these temperatures is not so easy as it seems. The surface itself, we have no maps about the surface you can use to set a roadmap for the rover. The rover had to find its own way and had to go it alone. And a really bad thing is regolith. The most part of the surface of the moon is covered in regolith, and regolith is a very, very bad thing. It's very abrasive, and there's a story that the Apollo astronauts have black hands from it. It came into their spacesuits, and so have we to make sure that our electronics, our bearings, have really good sealed to save it for regolith. Jürgen will say something about the components of the rover and their mass, so you can see how we planned.
Yeah, thanks to you, Michael. It's also from my side a hello to the audience. As a mechanical engineer, I never thought to speak on the CCC. It's a great pleasure for me. But now let's have a look on this side behind me. On this side, we will list the final components of our rover and their planned mass. Let's start with the first point. Is the mobility. The rover is equipped with four 360 degrees turnable wheels. Each wheel has one motor for traction and one motor for steering. To further enhance the mobility, each wheel is suspended by an independent passive wheel suspension. And the mass where one wheel include the traction motor won't exceed 250 grams. So 1 kilogram total for all four wheels. And the second point, there is the tower. The final version will have a turnable and tiltable camera tower. By design, this rover we will present you today doesn't have a camera tower. This has two reasons. Firstly, the main purpose for the prototype are the driving tests and also the tests of the electronics. And secondly, we have decided on one particular camera model yet. The size of the camera plays a considerable role in the design of such a tower. But the total mass of the tower shall not exceed 1 kilogram. Then we have the control. The main computing unit, or MCU, makes up the entire electronic component of the rover. Its mass include the tank holding it, shall not exceed 500 gram. Then the energy. We have a solar panel and the built-in phased array antenna of the final rover. We have added another 500 gram into the equation. And then there is a point reserved, one of the tasks defined by the XPRIZE Foundation include an additional payload. The mass will be somewhere between 100 and 500 gram. Yeah, and last but not least, and as I see it's not on the slide, all the parts are held together by a rocket frame made of, finally made of aluminium and carbon. The frame is the most important static element of the rover. A mass of 1 kilogram is achieved. So our mass goal for the rover is now accomplished. Back to Michael.
So, a little bit away from this theory, let's show some video of building a rover.
Soll ich tippen?
Ja.
Okay. Tipp du mal. It's just a placeholder, but it's important. Okay, let's switch to the video. Okay, let's see if we have sound in this. I'm not sure about it.
Here for real, our first prototype of a moon rover. So, let's take some look of the details. So. We have here the steering motors inside the frame, the traction motors inside the wheel. You can see here the frame. It holds everything on the rover. Here, this is a case for the electronics. The frame, again, the wheels before build for heißt montiert. Montage vor der Montage. Okay. The solar panel is just a mock-up right now, but we change that in the next half year. Arne will say in his presentation something more about the technology in the solar panel. And the optics, we haven't decided optics yet, but Schneider Kreuznach seems a big favorite for us. The optics you see here is HiRio certified and was used on a ISS space station, and it's very, very expensive. So, what up next year? New materials. We have to look for new materials to reduce the mass for scientific payload. And the idea was to use carbon fiber reinforced polymer, CFK. A new design for the tower and the frame. All that can you see on our homepage and Twitter and the blog. And if you have any questions today, we are standing outside at the booth, and I will be there and will answer. Arne will tell you something about the MCU.
Today I would like to talk about our electronics, especially the main computing unit. Moment. First, we have the requirements from the Google Lunar X Prize, for example, transmitting the HD video. The main problem is we need a lot of processing power, but also we are limited in selecting the parts. Not all are space compatible. So, yeah, we need also a flexible design. For example, we can't change the hardware every time. So we decided to use FPGA. The condition is that it has to be HiRio certified, so it will work also in space. One lifetime has two definitions. One is it has to live long enough on the moon. The other is it would be nice to reuse the design for later missions. So keep it simple and stupid. So don't add too much parts, not external video compression chips. So. Yeah, what is HiRio? That means, first, we have extended temperature ranges. The standard HiRio chips are from minus 55 to 125 degrees. That is still not enough for the moon, but it's the best you can buy here. So it means we have to test these parts if they can withstand the minus 160 degrees, or at least the 122, or, and for the worst case, the 160 degrees. There's also the radiation. HiRio components are tested against radiation. Oh. For example, we have the single event effects that are electrons or protons with a high speed that hits the ship And yeah, in worst case, it ends with a burnout effect. Whereas also the total ionizing dose, that means each event damages the ship a little bit, and if the total dose is reached, the ship will fail too. So, so currently we are working on the first prototype board. It is equipped with a Vertex 4 FX20 FPGA. It's a small one. It's not the final one. It's not space compatible. But it's enough for testing a few things. For example, we have a DDR RAM with 80 bit instead 64 or 75 too. That means we can test other error correction algorithms. For example, extended to up to 3 bits of 64 that can be corrected. But there are limitations. So there's another algorithm that could correct to various bits of the 64. Or a third configuration that allows to compensate one chip failure so that the 9 remaining chips will work like a standard ECC module. We have also a 5-channel NAND-flash interface. They should work in the RAID 3 mode. That means we can also compensate a chip failure of 1. So, yeah, for testing external hardware like cameras or motors, we have a VHDCI connector from SCSI. But we're using it for as GPIO for with 64 lines, and we have also 2 pin headers with 16 lines each. What can be used for hardware? Also, is there are 2 Ethernet fuses. It was not easy to get them. We can use them for debugging or using the board as router. So. To not waste the possibilities, we connect the multi-gigabit transceiver to a few SATA ports. So. So. Huh? So let's have a look inside the FPGA. We have a PowerPC 405 core. It's a hard core, so it's real in silicon. We don't have to use the FPGA logic to build it. We have also 2 Ethernet EMACs, so they are connected to the Ethernet fuse. When we have our DDR2 RAM, it's a multi-port memory controller. That is an IP core that is implemented with the FPGA logic. And it's connected to the PowerPC connector with 2 processor local buses. When we have also a few more peripherals, for example, the block RAM that contains the bootloader and UART that is connected to an S232 interface, an interrupt controller, an inter-EC controller for external sensors, for example, current or temperature, or maybe it's a real-time clock. So that is all things when you, that is provided by Xilinx. But now we have the components we have to develop ourselves, for example, the motor controller. So, the last part I want to talk about today is our concept for the antenna and the solar panel. A solar panel has a conflict with the antenna they require the same space. They are both large objects compared to the other components on the rover. So our only solution is embed the antennas into the solar panel. Maybe a few people here have heard from slotted array antennas. Some people use them for wireless LAN. So it's possible to embed the slots into the solar cell to implement a high gain antenna. We have two antennas embedded. One is an X-band antenna for transmitting. It requires a high bandwidth, for example, to transmit the HD video, and a low bandwidth antenna for receiving the comments. The data rate is not more than a serial line. I would like to give back to Ruba.
Okay, so let's see if Jack Quenchow is angry at us because we not answered his phone calls. Okay, now I'm going to call Jack Quenchow. Just to give you a short introduction about him. Jack Quenchow, you probably most know him because of he published really, really long list of articles in regards of embedded hardware development. He was on the Lunar Trajectory Group back in 1960, working on the original, completely entire Apollo program, and he did the lunar trajectory calculations there. So when he's one of the oldest geeks I know, absolutely. And he's pretty cool, and okay. So let's see if he talks to us. Okay. Yeah, it's quite a long list. Hello. First of all, he will tell something about himself and what he's done so far. And then he asked me to ask him two questions. Not more than two, because we have a presentation afterwards and it would take too long. You can't ask him 1,000 questions. I've did so, believe me. Just think of something you want to ask someone who worked on the original Apollo program. I will just select one randomly and ask him this question. If it works. Oh, das sieht gut aus.
Ja.
Ah, hello. Are you hearing me? Hello, Jack.
I've been having trouble getting the line.
Ah, I see. Okay. Can you start your video?
Yeah, how do you do that?
No problem. I'm just starting my video, so you can see me first. It should be on any minute, yeah? Hello? And
there you are.
Yeah, okay. And just at the bottom of the Skype window, you can see this blue button that you had yesterday. And you can click on it, and it shows Start My Video. It looks like... Okay, not too tight. Hello. I will try to hold the laptop in the regards of the audience, just to get a picture of them.
Yeah, I see you.
Hello.
Hello, man.
Okay. If you want, I can hold it this way. No problem.
Hi, guys. Okay, I'm sorry for all the problems. I couldn't seem to get online this morning.
Ah, no problem, no problem. Okay, now you're there. And
Okay.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Hello. You going to introduce me?
I introduce you a little bit, but can introduce yourself if you want to, additionally.
Okay. Well, I'm Jack Crenshaw. Some of you may have read my column or my tutorial on compiler theory. some time ago. I understand there's some interest in that. I'm a columnist for Embedded Systems Programming magazine, and I wrote a book called Software Toolbox for Real-Time Programmers. And the reason we're here today is because I worked on Project Apollo and things even before Project Apollo for NASA. Would you like to know more? I'm gonna take that as a yes. I was graduating from college in 1959. I interviewed a number of organizations, and one of them was NACA, which stands for National Advisory Committee on Aviation. That was founded back in 1913 or something like that. So I was, hoping I would get an offer from them in Langley, Virginia. Well, the offer letter came, and it was, I wish I still had that letter. It was on NACA stationery, and some secretary had crossed out the C and put an S above it. So basically, in the time that it took between the interview and the offer, NACA had been changed to NASA. I went to work there in April 59, and went to Langley, Virginia. I went to the Theoretical Mechanics Division and worked with a wonderful bunch of people, very small group, called the Lunar Trajectories Group. That name, I guess, tells you everything. Very small group. My boss was a fellow named Bill Michael. If you Google Bill Michael, you'll find a lot of information on him. He was involved in the debate over LOR versus Earth Orbit Rendezvous. You may remember, older folks may remember that. Robert Tolson was a colleague. He's also a helper on the part-time scientist group. So I think we have a sort of a unique situation in the sense that we have two of the original members of the Lunar Trajectories group, which only consisted of five people. So that's pretty interesting. You've all seen the figure eight trajectory. That's the circumlunar trajectory. It shows up everywhere, anywhere, anytime someone talks about lunar missions. Bill Michael and I were two of the first four people to write a paper on that. We wrote that in 1961. I did a lot of studies on that using a restricted three-body program. Maybe I should pause here and just point out Newtonian physics and Newtonian trajectories has got to be one of the purest applied math efforts in history, because you've just got a few masses, which can be treated as point masses, flying around each other and affected only by gravity. So it's a very clean environment. Unfortunately, the problem itself is not all that clean. If you look at the relationship, say for Mars orbit, it's basically a two-body problem, Sun and Mars. Nothing else matters. Same with Sun and the Earth, rather the Earth-Moon barycenter. But the motion of the Moon is a very complex thing, because the Sun perturbs it not negligible amount. So an accurate computation of the Earth-Sun-Moon system, and for the throw a spacecraft in there, is a four-body problem, and there's no easy solution for that. Way back in Newton's day, people like Lagrange worked on, they tried to get a simplified solution, and they worked out the restricted three-body model, which has only the Earth and the Moon moving in a plane and the trajectory of a spacecraft in the same plane. Actually, they were interested more in the motion of a comet in the solar system, but the math is the same. We had a restricted three-body program, and that's what I used for my studies. In 1960, I left NASA and went to work for General Electric. Basically, I followed the money. General Electric had been given a contract to do pre-Apollo studies, basically study the whole problem of getting to the moon and back. And I was hired in to help with that. And later on, there was a huge proposal effort for the production contract, which GE spent a lot of money on and worked very hard on. Unfortunately, they lost to North American. And there's some stories about skullduggery and the government that send that contract to them, but I won't go there. We were very disappointed in it. We did get a contract to do what they called reliability assessment, which was basically what's the probability that the astronauts will come back alive? That was number one. And what's the probability that they will that we'll complete the mission? So we had a huge efforts to answer those two questions, and a big computer program calculating the things that could go wrong. I was not too involved in that part. I continued with trajectory. Let me back up and say that at GE, I was responsible for all of the trajectories generated for the Apollo program, the study contract, and all that. We used an in-body program for that effort. And there was a lot of interesting stuff came out of that. You have to remember, this was 1960. Computers were brand new. I think the IBM 702 was out some years before. I think it was around 1955. But nobody really had them until the Apollo effort started. There were maybe three or four IBM 702s being used for scientific work before the Apollo effort and for NASA, and quite a few after, because all of the contractors to NASA pretty much had to buy those computers. Not cheap. Now, there's been a lot of talk about the power of these computers. Needless to say, an IBM 702 would not be a very impressive computer. Today it had 32K of RAM, no disks, only mag tape. So it was not a fast machine, but internally they did okay. And they had 36-bit word length, double precision floating point. It's hard for floating point. You could get some things done. When I was at GE, we had 7094s, which were a good bit faster. And later on, I went work for a company called Northrop Corporation, and we worked with ESA. George C. Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville. And there we had UNIVAC 1108s, CDC 6600s. And those guys were pretty fast in anybody's measure. The 6600 had a 60-bit word length and could really zoom. It was designed, I understand, by the same designer that designed supercomputers later. So we got a fair amount of work done. One of the things we found in the business of generating trajectories to the moon is it's not easy. Because of the interaction between the Earth, Moon, and the spacecraft, near the Earth, the trajectory looks exactly like a conic section, a two-body solution. And in our case, it's a very elongated ellipse because the perigee has to be near the Earth and the apogee has to be near the Moon. So that pretty well describes defines the orbit that you have to fly. In the vicinity of the Moon, it looks like a hyperbola, and it looks very much like a hyperbola. But there's that no man's land out between them that both bodies affect the spacecraft pretty heavily, and so the solution really requires all of the bodies to be present. And then if you add the Sun, it's orbit problem. I want to make a comment about why we have to add the Sun, and we and part-time scientists are working on that right now. The Sun, if we were talking about just the perturbation of the Sun, the spacecraft, it's low. Problem is that it perturbs the Moon as well. So if you're calculating a trajectory to the Moon, and you consider the effect of the Sun on the spacecraft, then you also have to consider the effect on the Moon itself. Otherwise, you get a situation where you're considering the acceleration of one body and not the other. The motion of the Moon due to the solar perturbation is extremely complex, and the Brown Hill theory involves thousands of terms in a Fourier expansion. So we're always looking for simplifications and modifications that will let us study the problem without having to generate these vectors. I will say that Robert was asking me yesterday how long it took to calculate one of these trajectories. And the answer is minutes, not hours, maybe 20 minutes. It's not a hard problem because if you're using a variable step Runge Kutta sort of integrator, it only takes a couple of hundred integration steps to get there. It's not like trying to calculate thousands of orbits of low Earth orbit. It's a simpler problem than that in terms of just integrating equations of motion. And so it doesn't take great gobs of computer power. I've calculated lunar trajectories on IBM 1130, which was an ancient 16-bit computer. You'll like the 1130. We had 16 K of RAM, that's K bytes, 16 K, and a hard drive with 512 K. And we were calculating lunar trajectories on that, so pretty interesting. Now, the part where it comes in more difficult is deciding how to get there. If you consider the problem, here I am in low Earth orbit and I want to go to the Moon, how do you do that? Where do I start the burn to go into translunar orbit? And how long do I thrust? All that sort of thing. You can, in an ordinary numerical integration, we do what we call are you seeing me bounce back and forth, I guess? I'll try to be still. If you give the trajectory an initial set of initial conditions, a position and velocity relative to the Earth, you just let it run, just integrating the equations of motion, you can follow it out and you arrive somewhere. But that somewhere is hardly ever at the Moon. You can go through some spherical trig sorts of calculations and help to narrow down the search, but eventually you're going to have to do a search. I first went to work for GE. They had none of that stuff. They had the in-body program, very accurate numerical integrator that could solve motion around all the planets plus the moon. But they had nothing in the way of calculating what the initial conditions should be. And their advice to me was, just run the trajectories till you get near the moon. And that's just not workable. It's, you've got 6 degrees of freedom. You can't just do trial and error on that. So what we did was I worked out a lot of spherical trig type stuff to come up with the geometry that we needed, the orbit plane, trajectory plane, the lunar orbit plane, so forth, of course, the equator, and work out the geometry that would get us near the moon. Now, because of the perturbation, you don't actually get there still. So you still have to do an iteration in some fashion. And the problem, when you look at it that way, is called the two-point boundary value problem. And it's one of the most difficult in dynamics to work, because it essentially involves an iteration on the initial conditions that will reach the final condition that you want. Well, during my period at both NASA and GE, I wrote quite a number of programs that would solve that. And that's really sort of what I claim to be my claim is that I claim to
Jack, hello?
There it is, I guess.
One thing, due to the time with passing, I think we should do the question part now, if you feel up to it.
Yeah? Okay.
If everything's fine with it?
I just wanted to say one more thing.
Yeah, okay, no problem. Sorry. Yep.
At GE, I worked on one of the first, I think, to work on abort trajectories. We had what we call a fast return, and the circumlunar trajectory was a free return. And if any of you saw the movie Apollo 13, there's a conversation there where, you know, the flight director gets told that there's a problem, and he says, can we do a fast return? And the other guy says, no, we'll have to do a free return. And I really like that exchange, because that just describes my entire work for Apollo. Okay.
Okay.
Any questions?
Can I just ask anyone who wants to ask a question, just to queue up and use the microphones here, rather than shout out, because poor old Jack's not going to hear it. Go ahead. Yep.
Hi. I was just curious, since you were talking about how computing power was so different back in the 60s compared to what it is now, if you are doing anything substantially different in terms of planning the trajectory for this mission, is there a different approach or different methods that you're using to take advantage of all of the computing power that you have now?
Actually, there is a couple. The first thing is that on the Apollo missions, even if we were landing on the moon, it was still a free return trajectory. Is there a problem? Okay. The idea was that when we leave the Earth, thing goes right, we need no mid-course corrections, our guidance has been perfect, we'll go back to the Earth and re-enter in a satisfactory re-entry corridor. We did that obviously for safety reasons, even when we were planning to land on the moon. We don't have to do that for the Lunar X prize. We if we miss the moon, we don't really care where it goes after that. So we can use trajectories that are a little bit different. And the key thing is the trajectory uses a little less energy than for the Apollo program. There is some interest in returning a rock sample from the moon, and the return from the moon is different also. For that is, we don't have to keep astronauts alive, so we can enter in a much steeper re-entry than was possible for Apollo. As far as the, there's not that much difference. I'll just emphasize again, we had to pretty much invent techniques on the fly because the computers were so new, but programs we got finally were pretty much the same ones we use today.
Any more questions?
Yes, no? If you've got any more questions, now's the time. Just come up, use the mic. Wow, stunned. Oh, we have a taker.
Hello, I was wondering, since there is no astronauts involved this time, is there some simplification you can do to the orbit, the trajectory, so that you don't have to have all the variables for a four-body problem? Or is there some simplification, or is the sun always involved, however you do it?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because there are quite a number of simplifications. The easiest one is just to execute a two-body orbit. If you think about it, the perigee of ellipse needs to be near the Earth. The apogee needs to be, it has to at least reach the orbit of the moon. So if you design an elliptical orbit, that eccentricity, if you time it right, you'll find that you do hit the moon. It's a lot easier when we're just trying to hit it as opposed to swing back. Also, there's some techniques that we worked out. There's a thing called patch conic. You might be familiar with that. Sometimes it's called matched conic. It's used a lot for interplanetary missions. There's what they call a sphere of influence around the moon. And if you make the assumption, simplifying assumption, that outside that sphere of influence, motion is fairly two-body relative to the Earth, inside it's two-body relative to the moon, then you can't get accurate trajectories, but you can get very nice motions that you can use for parametric studies, that kind of thing. There's an even more interesting one, which I think I invented. Now, you never know about these things, but it's based on a very simple principle. Because this orbit is almost parabolic, the energy turns out to be dependent only on the angular momentum. So if you leave the vicinity of the moon at the right angular momentum, which of course translates to a velocity relative to the Earth, then you're going to re-enter at the desired altitude. And I'll mention that in Apollo 13, remember they had to do manual burns, manual mid-course corrections to hit the re-entry corridor. That's how that was done. It was done strictly by matching the angular momentum that they needed. Next.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, I'm not sure about the schedule. As you thought, we've got one part left in regards of the communications. Is this okay? I think it's 15 minutes, should be fine. No? Okay. And I'm pretty sure you will like this part. Whew, okay. let's see if this works again. Oh, no, the mouse. Yeah, okay, special guest. Stop. 45 is absolutely perfect. I just need 15. Okay. That's okay, fine. Perfect. Okay. As you can see right there, and now for something completely different. So just get rid of trajectories and Google and XPath for first. And let's think about communication and how to do it a better way right now. So first of all, as we've developed a solution, I would like to start with the problem. So what is the problem? Because if you don't have a problem, why develop a solution? It's because it's quite boring. So, okay, first of all, we have space. Well, space is always, it's big, it's really big. It's cold, and most important, it's empty. It's not 100% empty, but you've got a giant distance between stars, between planets. So here we are, starting with our problem. Our first problem is distance. So just give you four examples. The first one we already know about is the distance between Earth and Moon. It's about 400 kilometers. That's fine, we've already heard that. Okay, so let's look at the distance between Earth and Mars. That's about 130 million kilometers. It's an average value because Mars has a relatively distinct rotation, rotationally distance fluctuations between Earth. There's a wonderful graphic on Wikipedia on this. And this is pretty cool. This is the distance between Earth and the farthest ever man-built object away from Earth still communicating with us. And it's 60.9 billion kilometers, if I'm correct. Yes. It's Voyager 1. It's pretty cool. Okay, so why I'm telling you this? Because with distance, always there's a problem. The problem is not just mathematics, because I'm not so much into mathematics. So I try to explain you this equation a little bit with some graphics. So let's look at this. We have our Earth. Everyone knows it. We have the geostationary orbit. On the geostationary orbit, we have all the satellites you can communicate with to do the important things like watching DVB-S HDTV all day. So communicating with this satellite is absolutely no problem. You can watch HD television, no problem. Okay. So let's look at something like this example. If we place this sending unit from the geostationary orbit in the orbit of the Moon, you will see that you need 100 times more signal strength to get the same signal back to Earth. So just to show you what this equation means, you can see if you look at the distance, because it's factor 10, you can see that's 1 divided by r power of 2. So you see how the equation works out. So what does this mean, this extreme high factor, 100? Okay, let's look at the next slide. You will see. Yeah, okay. Greater distance between two objects always leads to the fact that you need larger sending and receiving antennas. The interesting part of that is, it's not everyone thinks about antennas like the very large array in New Mexico. We have this very big high gain antennas, 30 diameter, and 15 pieces of it sorted like an X in the middle in the desert. So this is a big antennas. But if you read this sentence, you see you have to size the sending antenna too. So if you need high bandwidth, your craft, which is moving into space, always needs a larger, and more powerful and more energy-based antenna to transmit the same amount of data that it was transmitting by half the distance. So this is something you have to keep in mind, because energy is something you don't have in a spacecraft. The best energy option you have in a spacecraft is a radioisotopic generator. It's called RTG. Most people say, hey, use solar panels. Solar panels are great, but they have some problems, some side effects. First of all, sometimes you don't have direct sunlight, but that's not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is that solar panels sometimes, they have a limited lifetime. let's say, about 30 years and they're burned out. They are not producing the same amount of energy they produce in the first year. Solar panels have a distinct lifetime. Normally, the energy output starts increasing, and suddenly, after 1 or 2 years, it starts increasing and then starts decreasing of a defined lifetime. So RTG batteries have mostly a lifetime of, let's say, 200 years or so, which is quite enough. But as said before, you don't have this in a normal spacecraft. You can't simply go to a supermarket or so and buy an RTG battery because it's based on radioisotopic material. You simply don't get it, as the material itself. So what does this mean? So if you don't scale the sending side and the energy side accordingly, you always end up with a smaller bandwidth. You further you go away. So we'll give you some examples about bandwidth. It's quite interesting with the latest Mars missions. But let's look at the second side. There's two sides of this problem. The second side is availability. Availability can mean a lot, so I'm just to have prepared the following slide. The slide, you can see every object in our universe is rotating around its own axis, and some objects, like the moon, are even rotating around other planets, and at all they're rotating around the sun. So, you can see all these trajectories right here. Okay, you have trajectories again. okay, so let's take a look at, for example. So we have a craft right here. I've just sent up a spacecraft and it's traveling around Mars. I don't know why, but it's right there in this moment. So, and now I want to send some data to my spacecraft. Let's do a kernel update or something like this. So, but you can easily see the problem. In this point, you see, the spacecraft is not, let's say, human eye visible to Earth. So, in regards of radio communications, you don't always need visual seeing. You don't even need a visual line of sight. That's what I want. But in this case, Mars is simply so big that it blocks all communication signals. So you would have to wait for a window something like this, where your craft is somewhere here, maybe doing a Langevin transaction. And you can see, hey, cool, I got direct line of sight to Earth. So now I can sit down in my backyard in Berlin and do a kernel update. Really? Let's see at this. So let's look at our example. I've implemented some nice viewports for you. So for example, I'm sitting in Berlin, want to do my kernel update. So, but my spacecraft, viewport, it's surrounding the moon. We have a problem. The moon, where my spacecraft on the surface, is facing northern and southern American part of Earth. So the only antenna available listening to this communication and maybe able to upload and download data, maybe the VLA or some other antennas placed around the USA. So, let's introduce a new object, and this is... So everyone is talking about CubeSats right now. I don't know why, but most people are quite interested in them, so I introduced one. So, okay, some university launched a CubeSat, want to do a kernel update too. I don't know why, but all want to do it. And this university has a deal with NASA and want to use the VLA. This is quite a normal thing. Most universities and non-profit organizations use things like SETI or the Very Large Array in New Mexico to transmit and receive data. But look at this. If you see the trajectory of the CubeSat moving around the Earth, you see that it just has passed the VLA. So it takes a distinct amount of time, depending on the rotational speed of the CubeSat, to return into its communication window. So right now, for example, I would have to wait 24 hours to get my communication link back. This is something that's pretty not cool in regards of nowadays communication. So there are some solutions already to this, but these solutions aren't quite fit. But I will tell you about something more about this. Okay. So you see the problem with availability. You don't always have an antenna just in the shot. So, okay, let's come to the solution part. Okay. What do we need to build a solution for this problem? For this problem of distance and availability. First of all, we stick to an FPGA hardware. This is a component we really like. We use it in all our electronics, and this is one of the reasons why we've partnered with Xilinx. And What is the reason why we choose an FPGA as a control unit? FPGA can do great things. I'm sure some of you on this, are radio amateurs here in the audience, so they will know what it means to do frequency shifting. You have it on your VLAN adapter, does it all the time. An FPGA is, can do frequency shifting in hardware. An FPGA, you have to imagine that an FPGA is a chip itself which emulates an entire printed circuit board. So you can reroute it on the fly. You have a, you can change everything you want in regards of the frequency and subfrequencies. So FPGAs have so-called IP cores. Arne told you about it. IP cores are highly optimized subroutines which allow you to do very fast transactions that you couldn't do on a normal computer system. Things like stream modulation, doing on your normal PC, would simply knock out the entire system and you had 99% CPU usage and you couldn't use the system for anything else. Doing it with an FPGA just uses about, let's say, 5 or 3% of the entire system resources, and the system can still do a dozen of other things. So FPGAs are really suited for distributed tasks in this regard. Okay, and most important, it's all, I don't know any FPGA featuring a Windows system, so all FPGAs are based on GNU Linux system. So why is this important? This is important because you got the GNU toolchain with all daemons you need. This includes all the IP protocols and network layers. You will see why we need network layers in this regard. So, and you need our satellite dish. But most of you think, okay, I want to communicate with something in orbit around Moon. So you're thinking, okay, I need this large, high-gain antenna, 30 diameter long, and I put it on my rooftop. Okay, nobody has a rooftop that could hold that big antenna. So why not try to do this with a standard size antenna? The standard size antenna you can buy, the largest one, would be about 90 centimeters in diameter. This is a standard size antenna. If you buy it in China, you can get it for 10 euro. It's pretty cheap. It's not like the things you pay if you go to a normal media store. So, okay, we've got our standard dish. Now, our standard dish is just made to receive satellite TV. So we have to do some slight modifications for it, but you can easily find it through Google, and it's quite easy if you ask someone who's from the radio amateur section. So you can do sending and receiving with the satellite dish. But, and this is very important, exclusively in Germany, you have to always make sure that your, everything you do is compliant with the amateur radio regulations. Because if you do not, you can get arrested for it. Okay, so we've got these two parts, and now let's see what we can make out of it. So this picture is pretty full of a lot of stuff, so I will start explaining it all separately. Let's start again. Do you see a lot of blue points? What is this? I don't know. Earth is not sick or something like this. And okay, let's start. The blue points are so-called, as we call it, link stations. A link station is simply both components bound together. We got a FPGA lined up with a satellite dish and some additional component to do the frequency controlling. It's just some electronics around it. So all this together gives a tiny black box that is mounted on the surface, or the back surface of the parabolic antenna. And the parabolic antenna itself is featured on a steering motor, so it can be rotated in any direction. There are a lot of details in this regard, so if you're interested in getting details about this link station, just talk to me outside after the presentation. So just keep it simple. So this link station has a Linux system running, has a satellite dish attached, can shift any frequency at once, and can send and receive data. And one additional thing, it's connected to the internet. So some of you already imagine what you can do with something like this. So first of all, you say, oh God, this costs a lot of money. Nope, it doesn't. If you think about FPGA hardware, we already built prototypes in this regard. We're talking about less than 1,000 euros for one unit. So it's definitely easy to deploy because it's not very expensive. I will tell you a little bit about our current prototyping status after we'll do it with this slide. Okay, so we have connected all these dots in the internet, so let's connect them to a central gateway. For our sake of simplicity, I say just a central gateway is sitting here somewhere in Germany. Okay, and all systems are connected via the internet to this gateway. So now, We have our surface probe on the moon, and we want to communicate with it. So, to communicate with the moon, you need a relatively large antenna with, let's say, at least 15 meters in diameter. But you only have 90 centimeters in diameter. How can you do this? Just as simple. As due to the capability of frequency shifting, you can take a big frequency, divide it by, let's say, 500 megahertz, separate it on multiple link stations. In this case, let's say 15 or so, put them in a so-called pool. You all know cloud computing. I think most of you do. It's exactly the same subject. You combine them, and you have, let's say, communication cloud. I always call it link pool. And this pool just receives segmentated the frequency with at least one load acting as a backup link. So what do we have right now? If you take the laws of physics, calculating the spectrum and the band you've got here with this combined antennas, you end up with an antenna that's even larger than a 30 diameter antenna that you have in the AGA at the Very Large Array in New Mexico. So this is something pretty cool. So you get a very big antenna distributed, in this example, across America. And it's just very small, on a rooftop, on a building, and you can't even see the difference to a normal satellite dish. Maybe you can, but it's not the original intention. So, okay, now we have to recall the fact everything is moving, and it's moving pretty fast. In regards of Mars, very fast. So we have the problem Mars is really hunting down over the Earth with all these communication windows. So one good thing about this approach is you're using the same effect that you have in the cloud computing using about distributed computing power. You have an always standby backup units right in the spot like this one. So if you imagine that Mars is moving this side, then this unit is already turning around to Mars, setting everything up, pulling into the frequencies, and if this one goes out, it takes over. So you end up with a, and this is very interesting, just go to the next slide and we can go back again. This. This is something that really took a lot of work, but it looks quite easy. You've got a lot of numbers in here. So we did some number crunching as we started building our prototypes to see what we've come up with this system. So if you do one single link station, with a 90 centimeter diameter antenna, could be transmitting more than 50 megabits up and down speed to a satellite in a geostationary orbit. And now comes the interesting part. The geostationary orbit is 37,000 kilometers away from Earth. And the most important thing, it's 24/7. Why is it 24/7? So, as you see, all are 24/7. Our goal is to be placed at least around 100 nodes around Earth. It may sound a lot, but if you think about it, 100 nodes, it would just mean about two or three nodes in Germany, and it's quite easy to find someone who just takes a satellite dish in his backyard, plugs it into the internet, and it's okay. So it's not quite much. To name something about this, the energy consumption of the entire system, it does not exceed more than 100 watt. So your computer does use more energy than one of the stations. Okay. I want to explain why it's 24/7. Just go back. As you see, in the large number of stations and this, with rotating principles of the pools, you can see that there's almost an ultimate available link pool on every side of the Earth. So if Mars is rotating around Earth, the link pool is always following Mars. Or more precisely, it's beforehand there, so Mars can just get into the spot, communication can happen, and so on. So it's really is complicated, the technology behind this, because you have to do recalculate all the data packets, because you receive them at different times, you have the delays in internet, and so on. But we have protocols and ways found to deal with this, so if you need more details in this regard, just ask me. Okay. So back to our number sheet. So one interesting thing for our team, as we are a team participating in the Google Maps Prize, is this one thing. This is quite normal. We are communicating with planets. Yeah, great, okay. But communicating with an object on the surface is something completely different. So we have here the Mooncast. This means our rover is standing on the surface of the moon, and we want to transmit data. Our rover has a relatively low energy budget. Current estimations are about, let's say, 60 watt at best. So if you have noon at moon day, you have 60 watt due to the solar energy, not more. Normally, let's calculate with 40 watt. 20 watt is the total energy available at best for the antenna. As you saw on Arne's presentation, the antenna and communication system is one combined unit. This is something really special. It's a self-developed technology in this regard. So, and we have calculated that we can use only, we need 15 link stations, 15 is an important number in this regard, to get 50 megabits down speed, and most important, 500 kilobits megabit up speed, and again, 24/7. This may not be that much that you've got when you consider your VDSL Anschluss or connection or something like this, but it is enough to fulfill the requirements set by the Mooncast. And that's very important. Okay. Okay, so let's look at these examples. So if you see Earth to the Moon. Earth to the Moon is quite easy again. It's like the geostationary orbit because the distance isn't that big because 40,000, 400,000, okay, there is a difference, but it's not that much compared to this number. And if you look at Earth, it's again 50 megabits, but not more, definitely not more. And this is very important. The system, if you calculate 100 link stations on the entire Earth, facing at least half of them to the object you are communicating with, you could end up with a bandwidth from Earth to Mars with 5 megabits by a distance of 130 million kilometers. So why is this important? Currently, NASA has some Mars exploration missions going on, and if I'm correctly, they are currently using only about 50 kilobits of their bandwidth to communicate downstream data with Earth. They could use about let's say 1 megabit, but not more currently. That's had to do with the technology they've embedded in their on their sending side at the probes. So our goal is to have lower energy requirements on the sending part, so in deep space, but have to larger antennas, virtual antennas, not real ones, because real antennas have limitations. You can't build a 60 diameter antenna. Okay, you can, but you don't have the place for this, and you have to build it all over the surface. So distributing the antenna as a virtual antenna grid around Earth is a quite great option. So you got Earth as one big antenna. Oh, just... have to imagine this. Okay. So one thing to note about this is we already have this problem a lot in regards of space communication. For example, with the Apollo moon landing, NASA sent out chips for the coasts to extend the communication window with the crew on the lunar surface to get a full-time video sequence. Otherwise, they had to wait at length, it was 4 hours to get the next communication window. But they wanted to do a live streaming of this. So they had to manually extend with chips their communication grid. They do pretty much, not pretty much the same in regards of technology, but of the idea. Yeah, this is currently a project we're working on. We've already have developed some prototypes in this regard, and this is very important about this. We're not talking about a simple idea. We have partnered with two companies in this regard, which I can't name right now, sorry. And they've agreed to allow us to place more than 100 stations. So they are giving us place at their grounds to place the stations where we have internet and the needed maintenance, because if something like a tsunami comes and your dish gets got rolled over, someone has to pull it up and check it again. So we always need a technician in place. Not all time, but sometimes once a year or so. Yeah. And this is, let's say, our biggest side project for 2010. We want to start with a small node network, like, let's say, 15 nodes, and see how this works out. Yeah. One thing about this that should be interesting for all of you, due to patent and other things like this, everything we do here will be licensed as Creative Commons completely. So this technology will be available to everyone, because the only way something like this can work is everyone could participate in this. So everyone can decide, I want to put a link station in my garden and want to get a bandwidth share of this network. So you can pull the internet from Earth into space. And this enables to do something pretty cool things in future. So just have to lay the ground for it right now. Yeah, I have to say that's pretty much it. Because I haven't prepared an ending slide for this. I just thought about it. Is there time for questions or not? Ah, so okay.
We're booked until three.
Oh, okay. 20 minutes. Oh, great.
Yeah. See, we've got like 20 minutes for questions.
One thing I have to say about this, that I'm just the one who presenting this idea. The development behind this has been done by persons in our teams, by these 43 team members I mentioned before. So I can't answer all questions. I can mention most of them. So if you want, ask. If you need some details or so, I could show you them afterwards on my laptop. I've got a lot of technical data and stuff and images like this.
So if anyone has questions, can they just go up to the mics and just go for it?
Even to other topics we had before, like the rover or so.
Yep, rover, the communication side, the whole thing. Go for it. Go on, you've got questions.
Otherwise, we will be at our booth till 8 p.m. today. So no problem, no hurry in this regard.
All right, I have a question.
Okay, absolutely. Shoot it.
So if I wanted to, say, borrow some nodes to create an enormous radio telescope, presumably that could be done at some later date.
It depends on how you build up the network in regards of management, not in regards of technology. In technology, it's all dumped nodes connected together, and you say, you do this, and you do this. One idea to do the management, right now all nodes are built up by us ourselves, but if we start incorporating different nodes, one thing I didn't mention, the concept itself is completely built to incorporate existing high-gain antennas completely. No problem. You could connect the VLA to this network, no problem. This is to completely, the entire, all protocols are developed for this especially. Okay, and to conclude in this, I think the most fairest approach would be to give everyone a share according to the link stations he donated to the network. For example, if someone is providing hosting space for 15 link stations, he could get a link pool of 15 stations. And the stations aren't fixed. Mars is not communicating with station 21, 23, 24, 25. It's communicating with 10 stations. Don't matter which one is what, because they are rotating. So you get a number, and you're just borrowing it, so for example. But you have to provide something for this. So I think it sounds like a good approach.
My inner astronomer. I did astronomy and space science at university, so this is fascinating. Okay, we have some questions. Go ahead, guys. Hit it.
Quick question. You probably need to synchronize all these stations in some way so they can transmit their data at the right time. How exactly do you synchronize them, and what precision do you need to have them synchronized?
That's quite a complicated topic. Let's do it in the other way around. Synchronizing them on the receiving side is a lot easier to explain for everyone. So if we receive data packets from, let's say, from the moon, and you receive them distributed take this big part again. So every station has a GPS receiver. The GPS receiver is equipped with to get the current position and to get a relatively exact time. So every package that is received is packed up into, let's say, 2 megabyte chunks and stamped with a timestamp. This timestamp will be transmitted to the server, and the server will be able, we've already tested this, the timestamp provided by the GPS network is detailed enough to do what we want to do. So it's a little complicated to explain in this regard. But all packets are timestamped, and with the timestamps they can be reorganized so they are a fully stream at the end of data.
So your source for the timing is actually a GPS receiver, you're not using NTP, for example, or something like that. You're just using an NTP receiver.
Sorry, I have to say that I didn't understand this correctly acoustically.
Sorry.
No problem.
So you're using a GPS receiver to for your timing source. You're not using NTP or the internet.
To get the time code, yes. Uh-huh, to get the timing. Hmm?
Thank you.
No problem.
Hello.
Oh, okay.
Did I understand correctly that you are already past the prototype stage? You've already got quite a few link stations deployed and becoming more and more stations. And
we've just done more than one year about the theory work with this, mm-hmm. because the theory behind this is really complicated, all the formulas. And we started developing our prototype link stations, and we've showed it to some companies where we know they could be interested, not in buying them, but in helping us building a test network. Mm-hmm. We are talking about, okay, the prototyping network we are building up will be using amateur radio frequency only. This does do some severe limitations of this, because it's not allowed to transmit encrypted data on amateur radio frequencies. This is something that's quite clear right now. So in the first prototype network, you can only do what you are allowed to do as an amateur radio specialist. Yes.
And what's the time frame to get the first real space communication up?
for me, and we don't have the X Prize, then next month or so. But as we are doing the X Prize beside this, I think my personal goal is by the end of next year. Okay. Maybe we can do a follow-up presentation on our progress if you're interested.
Thank you.
Yeah, I have two questions. The first question is to your economical situation. You said you just need 15 million euros to build this. That's what I mean.
Yeah, you're referring to the first presentation where
yeah,
we talked.
Yeah, okay. To your first presentation. Yeah.
Okay.
And I wonder, does this calculation include salary for people, like engineering costs, or is it just the cost for the material?
Yeah, I know what you mean. You mean the paying for the manpower we use.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Just look at our name, part-time scientists.
Yeah.
I think it just answers it. Not
yeah,
that I want
just,
to answer
yeah.
it anymore, but it just says it. We're doing it in our free time.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally have the opinion that people who work on something in their free time are much more motivated than they were in their normal work day.
I totally agree. Definitely. But I guess this is also the reason why you only need 15 million and not just
Not really. 16. We've calculated all the manpower cost in our regard with a relatively small team. I think about 50 people, and we came up with about 3 million. So it's not that much. We should have 3 million, but it's compared to numbers like 60 billion or so, you see,
yeah.
It's quite a small amount in this regard.
Okay.
It's just one thing. We are not going to buy a new room, set in 50 people, and let's do some talkings for a year. Just be getting to work. It's all we really want to do.
Okay. The second small question is: all this stuff you send up in space, all this materials usually needs to be certified or like tested for space engineering. Do you use this material only, or is it easy to get access to this kind of material?
Yeah, that is a very good question. Okay, for our rover prototype development, we try to use as much as high-wheel certified components as possible. But to do this with a rover prototype, it's really expensive. But now comes the interesting part. As we have Texas Instruments as our partners, we are getting a lot of high-wheel certified components from them for free. So all our electronic devices are, let's say, not certified for high wheel, but they should be. So if I should try to certify them, they could pass. So this is our goal. We're always building them in a way, not the current prototype. This is, I have to say, but all intended prototypes always feature most high wheel components only.
Yeah. Okay.
And yeah, in future, it will be only high wheel certified components, yes.
Hello. I just wanted to ask, with the many distributed link stations you have, how do you get around the problem of differing quality between links, say, because of different types of hardware or because of weather effects?
I think you're talking about the issue with ionization of atmosphere.
But with many different link stations, they won't all have the same quality.
So No. I know what you mean. Okay. This is something you have to always keep in, like in cloud computing systems, you always have to keep in backups. You can't say, okay, I just need three stations to do communications, so you're just associating six stations or five with it. So if you have the problem with ionization of atmosphere, that's why I talked about it, because someday at noon, if you have a, in summer, you can get a problem that the ionosphere is so much ionized that you can't get a signal through, even you're seeing the object right in front of you. I'm not an expert, so I just can tell you what I've learned in this regard. So, okay. And in this case, another station, which has a better receiving capability, could simply take over. Anyway, as we are using backup stations, we always have two signals, so we can do some correlation or say, okay, we're using this signal because it's stronger and this is ignored.
Thank you.
And we have the problem, so, no, I don't want to let you go, but we have, always have the problem of fluctuation in the internet speed. We have to keep in account this, so this is why the reason you always need backup stations.
So, first question, do you plan to use a backup engine on the lunar lander or just one?
I'm not sure if I can answer this 100%. This is more a question about for our aerospace sub-team. Okay. I think it would be better you ask them outside, because okay. The engine for the lander is, as I said before, it's not just a secret because of contracts, but it's very complicated, and I definitely don't understand all the equations in this regard. So just ask them. They are pretty much open to this.
Okay, yeah? And second question, do you have any energy left on the rover to do some kind of thermal control actively? Or only a passive?
Okay, I see. You mean thermal control. Yeah. Right now the design aims to be immune against thermal problems. So it's not a good thing to do cooling all time and heating at night and so on. You can only do this if you have a radioisotopic generator. This is what NASA do all the time. They're putting in radioisotopic generators. Radioisotopic generators are produce pretty much heat. So at the night you have the heat from the generator, and at day you have the problem, you have to pull out the generator because the heat gets overheating. So we are not using countermeasures against the temperature. We're just building everything to withstand it right now in the design. I can't for 100% tell if the final version would have some way of cooling system. But right now we discarded this concept.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I have a question concerning the testing process of those link stations. So let's assume you have hundreds of link stations in place, maybe in 2 months or so, on Earth. So that isn't a problem. But you don't have a sender on Moon. And as far as I understood your concept, you don't plan to trash some lunar landers just to bring a sender to the Moon and test your link stations in the field. So how do you plan to do this?
I'm seeing what you mean. There are two parts of this. The first... it's gone black.
Flat battery.
Swipe your finger. Okay. Just get to what I want to say.
The testing process with you have the receivers here, the link stations, but no sender on the Moon.
First things. In the prototyping network, due to licensing, we can only use the amateur radio frequency, which limits us to some parts of the X-band in this regard. So to say this, there are a lot of components out there from AMSATs, for example, which are transmitting on this frequency, which you could receive with this network, for example. So it's not like there's nothing out there which is transmitting on this band. You can use them. In a final version, it would be good to have a licensed your own band for this network. It would be the best solution, but licensing a band, I don't know how much it costs, but I can only guess it's multiple millions of dollars to get your own band license for... I'm not an expert, so I only read about it. It's very, very expensive. So, yes, with the prototyping network, you can receive everything that's working on this amateur frequency, and that's a lot of components, because AMSAT was working pretty hard to get a lot of stuff up there in the recent years.
Okay, so you're basically using junk that's up there and sending something to...
Just to show if it works, yes. But in the end, it would be good. We want to offer all Google Lunar X Prize teams. It's not just that's why one of the reasons why we do say it we do Creative Commons. Other Google Lunar X Prize teams could use this network too. So it should provide a solution not just for our team, but for other teams too, and for other people who are in the need for something like this. Because one thing I have to tell you, for example, I'm the team leader of the part-time scientists. If I want to communicate with my craft on the moon, because imagine it had landed right now, okay, and I want to show you some live feed from it. I would have to contact NASA, no, not NASA correctly, it's an agency from SETI and sub-agency. I would have to contact them 3 months before to get a communication window of 2 hours. That's flexibility. Absolutely.
Okay, thanks.
Early on, for one of the X prizes, it was mentioned that there would need to be a 100 to 150 gram payload. Hmm? Any idea what kind of payload this could be? Is it supplied or is it from
the team? It's supplied by the Google Lunar X Prize Foundation. They have a website where you can, I don't know if I read it correctly, you can, as a person, buy part of the payload the team's having. So you can say, okay, I have this very important thing and want to send it up there, so I pay you 5 million. And the X Prize Foundation gets this 5 million and gives us, or the team which is transmitting this item, a fair share of it. But I don't know what equipment is exactly. It's not defined. It will be defined by the end of 2011. Sorry.
Okay, so it's not some dead weight, just.
So, sorry.
Well, I've got two questions. The first is about the bandwidth. You mentioned that multiple receivers on Earth are there and located and share a 500 megahertz band. And the synchronization, is it done live or do you do it afterwards?
Ah, I see. It depends pretty much on the, as I said, we need a central gateway server. And this central gateway server really needs a lot of processing power. We are not talking about renting a server at 1-to-1 or something like a gaming server. We are talking about something like an IBM Excel rack or something like this. So you need really the processing power to combine all this data. Then you could do it live, yes. But otherwise, you would have to do a little bit delay in this, yeah.
Would also be the problem of getting the data to the central gateway servers. So
yeah, in regard of bandwidth, yes. If you have a data center, like if you want to host it at 1-to-1 again, just an example, and 1-to-1, I think the biggest bandwidth they're hosting is 1 gigabit per server. So yes, imagine if you got 50 link stations connected to this server, it's just up to limits. Except if you are working with load balancing systems, but it's more a network administrator related topic.
Well, thanks. Do we have any more questions? We've still got like 5 minutes, or we can break 5 minutes early for lunch. No? Nothing else? Okay, so thank you very much. Well, you all sound rather full-time scientists to me. thank you very much to the part-time scientists, I wish you all the very best. I think everyone actually wishes you the very best of luck. Don't blow up on the launch pad with your borrowed rocket.
Thank you.
You know, Please tell me the whole thing is insured and there's actually two of them. Hmm? Please tell me the whole thing is insured and there's actually more than one of your rovers and devices. So if you blow up on the launch pad, you can have another go.
I see. We always, as I'm personally, I'm in business terms, I'm a network administrator, so I'm more into clustering systems. That is the reason why we're having 3 items of everything. Never do it once. No, never, ever. Imagine it would break. So if you have 3 items, for example, I know that the DLR has, I know it's a rule, but I know that some missions had about 15 backup items. It's pretty cool.